Call the Sunday, June 24th, meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. And I will open the long-awaited work session on Senate Bill 10. And members, you should have in front of you several things. One is the bill as it came over from the Senate, which is the de-engrossed version of Senate Bill 10. A companion to that is a document that says Senate Bill 10B section-by-section analysis that was compiled by our staff, dated June 20th. And then there are several sets of amendments. I am not familiar with most of them. The one I am familiar with is the -B34, which is an extensive amendment which includes a few substantive changes to the bill and then a bunch of conflict amendments. So we can, I suppose, start by going through the original bill. It's pretty extensive, and perhaps, Jim, would you like to just sort of summarize this?
I have the one-paragraph summary. I have the eight-page section-by-section. I'll start with the one-paragraph summary and see if you want me to go beyond that, all right?
Thank you.
This is Senate Bill 10B. It makes changes to government ethics laws, establishes a funding system for the Government Standards and Practices Commission, assessing state agencies and local government entities. It requires quarterly filing of expenditure statements by lobbyists and directs the commission to make the statements publicly available on the Internet. It increases penalties from $1,000 to $5,000 for violations of lobbying or government ethics law. It prohibits former legislators from lobbying during the first regular session out of the Legislative Assembly and defines regular session. It sets monetary limit on gifts received by public officials from people with legislative or administrative interests. It exempts certain food, beverage, travel, lodging, and receptions from the definition of the gift. It exempts judges and the Judicial Department from gift limits. It modifies requirements for contents of statement of economic interest. It requires public officials and candidates to report specified information quarterly. It modifies reporting requirements for honoraria. It authorized public officials to establish legal expense trust funds to defray certain legal expenses upon approval of the GSPC. It also declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Okay. So that is the original bill, members. Do you want an explanation that goes in more detail through the original bill? Or would you like to hear about the -34 amendment? Okay, I see head nods about the -34 amendment, and I see our very exhausted and very capable Ted Rettlinger in the audience. So, Ted, would you please come forward, and first let me just thank you from the bottom of my heart for having worked virtually nonstop, I know now, for days. At least the parts of your work I am familiar with. I know you've been working exhaustively to try to crank out a product that is consistent. So the -B34 amendments are certain changes that were requested by myself in the Speaker's office, and then a lot of changes or just conflict provisions is my understanding. Yes. So if you could talk through those, that would be extremely helpful.
Certainly. For the record, Ted Reutlinger with the Legislative Council's office, thank you for your kind words about our efforts to produce this bill. I'd like to, before I summarize these, thank specifically the editors and the people in Publication Services and Legislative Council, particularly Mike Stock, Alicia Meyer, and Vicki Kreider, who worked long into the night last night and were here early this morning trying to get these amendments done. These conflicts are complicated, and our folks do excellent and important work on them, and I just wanted to acknowledge and thank them. The -34s do several major things. First of all, it exempts volunteers from the assessment piece, the funding part in Section 1 of Senate Bill 10, so that when the GSPC is counting people for purposes of the assessment, they would only be counting officials and employees. The second part is this bill contains two quarterly reporting provisions, one for lobbyists, one for public officials who have to file certain reports. This bill, this amendment changes the January filing date from January 7th to January 15th for the previous quarter. The third change is that it directs the GSPC to report recommended statutory changes to the lobby law and the ethics law to the legislature not later than February 2nd of each odd-numbered year. The fourth thing is the gifts. This is sort of the meat of the amendment. The first thing it does is delete in the B engrossed bill the language that exempts gifts from personal friends on special occasions. It simply takes that exemption out of the bill. The second thing it does on the...
And Ted, not to interrupt the flow too much, but that would only apply to friends of an elected official who have a legislative or other interest before whatever body the elected official serves, is that correct? Because
sure,
others are not prohibited
yes.
from giving gifts.
The gift ban applies to gifts from people with a legislative or administrative interest. This bill specifically allows gifts from people who do not have a legislative or administrative interest. The next change in the gift statute is the exemption now for unsolicited tokens and awards of appreciation. That's now unlimited. This bill, this amendment would limit those to gifts with a resale value of $25 or less. The third change to the gift exemptions is in the exemption for unsolicited informational material. We've taken out the word unsolicited so that it would apply to any informational material that's provided to a public official, whether solicited or unsolicited. Then on page 15 of the bill, in large I, lines 16 through 20, this is the exemption for food, lodging, and travel expenses for people who are going on trade promotion or fact-finding missions. What this bill, the amendments do is
so
take out...
Will we hold that thought for just a minute while we catch up with where you are?
He's on the B engrossed. He's working off the B engrossed page numbers, not the
amendments.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
B engrossed.
Page 15 of the B engrossed bill.
Oh, the B engrossed bill.
Okay.
Do you need a paper copy, Representative Esquivel, or are you ahead of us?
I'm fine.
And it's on page 10 and 11 of the B-34 amendments.
Okay.
So at the bottom of page 10 of the B-34 amendments, they amend the food, lodging, and travel expense section for trade promotion, fact-finding missions, or other official business. What the amendments do is take out the phrase "or other official business" and put in the phrase to cover expenses for people who are involved in officially designated negotiations where receipt of the food, lodging, and travel expenses are specifically approved in advance.
Well, you're on page 14.
Madam Chair?
I'm on page 15 of the B engrossed bill and page 10 and 11 of the B-34 amendments.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Can you give us an example of how that plays out, received expenses approved in advance? For instance, a county commissioner was negotiating a contract someplace, that county commissioner would have to get approval of the expenditures in advance of the trip that they were going to take?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, yes, I believe that is correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you. I think I'm comparing the amendment to the section. So in terms of the advanced approval, if you're on, the port of Coos Bay, it's going to get all this great container traffic coming in a few years, they're going over trying to attract a new container carrier. And they're on, they're in Asia somewhere, and they're on one of these trips. Do they have to get each specific expense approved in advance? They're negotiating for some expanded container business. give me a sense, the receipt of the expenses is approved in advance.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, assuming that they're not on a trade promotion or fact-finding mission, that they are involved in negotiations, I believe this language is drafted broadly enough to require the port simply to approve the receipt of expenses related to this trip, period. They would not have to receive specific approval for X dollars of food and Y dollars for lodging. And the GSPC in this amendment is specifically directed to adopt rules that interpret the applicability of all of these exemptions from the definition of gifts. So they would be adopting administrative rules interpreting this statute and giving people information about how to apply them. The next thing that happens away from the gift exemptions is on page 17 of the amendment, new language that prohibits public officials who have left public service from using confidential information that they gained while they were in public service for their own personal use. This language is taken specifically from House Bill 2594, which is one of the Oregon Law Commission ethics bills.
925.
Then on page 18 of the Being Gross bill, we have a new prohibition on entertainment, the receipt and giving of entertainment. The B34 amendments prohibit a person with a legislative or administrative interest from paying for any entertainment expenses for a public official. Under the Being Gross bill, as it's currently written, those entertainment expenses would, for the most part, be subject to a $50 limit. This amendment simply prohibits them, notwithstanding that $50 limit. And then it carves out two exceptions to that entertainment ban.
Ted, could you refer to where you are in the dash B34s?
On the B34s, I am on page 18, starting at the very top, line 1. That's the language that says a public official cannot receive any gift of payment of entertainment expenses. And then there are two exceptions to that, which are added back into page 15 of the Being Gross bill, which cover the receipt of entertainment that's incidental to the main purpose of some other event that a public official might be attending.
And now I think we've lost
I've lost myself.
top of page 15 of the amendment.
Top of the amendment?
If you look at the top of page 15 of the Being Gross amendment, it's easier to see it there.
Thank you.
This is part of the conflict amendment. But if you look on page 15, lines 5 through 10, these are the two instances where the receipt of entertainment would be allowed by a public official. If the entertainment is incidental to the main purpose of some other event, if you go to a reception and there happens to be a band or some other thing going on there. The second is entertainment that's provided to a public official where the public official's at the event to appear in a ceremonial capacity. If you are going to throw out the first pitch at the World Series, for example, and you get tickets, this would cover you there.
Yes, Representative Roble.
There's been a concern on this particular portion and a couple others that we relate that to 174.11 and 174.16, but we don't relate it to 174.117. Was that purposefully? I mean, that's school districts, school boards, and other community colleges. It's a whole lot of other public officials that are not included in those other two, and so they would not be exempt, if I understand it. So, if they went to an organizational thing like Confederated Schools Administrators, the incidental entertainment that happens at those would not be allowed. as I understand.
Madam Chair, Representative Rogan, you're absolutely right. I think that was simply an oversight, and I'd recommend that if you want to cover those people, that we do add, I believe it's special government bodies as defined in 174.117. That would capture ESDs, school districts, some of the other people who are not defined as local governments.
Although, Ted, that exception for entertainment provided that's incidental to the event, that applies to anybody covered by these statutes, right?
Yes, it does.
So
sure.
I think we aren't covered by the statute. Well, that's another section that you're looking at.
No, yeah, but the 117 group is not included in the other part either.
So I guess I'm not tracking here. The issue that was raised to me was for fact-finding missions or negotiations that we had not specifically said that school district right. employees or community college mm-hmm. districts would
sure
be covered by those exceptions. So
that's part of it as well. But I just worry about it here. Is not having it here the same problem as not having it in those other places as well? That's why I'm raising the question. And my belief is that it is. It's just that they hadn't pointed out those sections to us yet.
And Chair?
Yeah. Representative Buckley.
Representative Roman, if I ask, then you're suggesting that everywhere we see ORS 174.116, we should also see ORS 174.116.
If we want to exempt those people, is my understanding. That's how I read it, and I guess I'll leave that up to the expert, not me.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So it'll also be on page 14.
Right.
Yeah, page 14 was the place that it had been raised
15,
with
16.
Me. But that is the section that applies to the fact-finding missions or officially designated
right.
negotiations. 16, I guess, I mean, the question would be, do school district employees get free admission to sporting events or other kinds of events where they are appearing in their official capacity for a ceremonial purpose? And
time.
Mm-hmm. It would depend on M when it says incidental issues. If we go back to some of the other statutes, it says that if you go to an organization that's provided by a nonprofit, i.e. an association like COSA or OSCA or any of those, they have a convention. During that convention, there's incidental music and other kinds of things. Does that entertainment there pose a problem for them under any of these other circumstances? And I guess that's my concern. And I mean, if it doesn't hurt to put it in, I guess that is what I'm saying. I don't know the answer to that question.
And
I just get concerned about having this them excluded by not referenced.
Right. And that, I mean, I heard you raise that point, but Ted, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that lines 5 and 6 of the dash 34s did specify that entertainment provided to any public official or relative of a public official covered by the ethics statutes that was incidental to the main purpose of the event was an exclusion. It was
correct.
Specifically not a gift. For
I'm sure that is correct.
Covered
any,
by these
including,
laws.
Including the school people. That would not be a problem.
Under the incidental exemption, that covers all public officials regardless. The entertainment exemption here that we're talking about, the trade mission exemption that we talked about earlier, and the expenses that can be received by public officials where the trip expenses where a federal government, state government, et cetera, pays for them, all of those three sections refer to state governments defined in 174.111, local as 174.116, but does not cover the special government bodies in 174.117. I believe that that's simply a drafting oversight. I don't recall anybody ever telling me not to include those people.
And so my only other one, you asked about a baseball game or whatever, and I guess only because of my experiences, I would say that yes, that can happen.
Right.
That there are times when, for example, a young man happens to be a son of a school board member, is killed in a foreign war, and they decide that they're going to honor that particular thing, and they invite that representative to come and throw the first ball out because they are honoring that situation. All of a sudden, he's a school board member, and they have to say no. I just worry about when you leave it out. You're excluding a group of people who are doing something in a, as a public body, and I don't want them to get excluded unless there's a purpose for excluding them, is my issue. So
that may have been an inadvertent omission. It would be easy to add that back in.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks.
Okay. In connection with this entertainment exemption, there's new language in the rulemaking sections for the GSPC, which is back on page 1 of the B34 amendment, which requires the GSPC to adopt rules that describe the application of all of these exemptions from the definition of gift, and that also describe how the commission is going to apply this ban on entertainment. So they would be required to adopt rules on that subject that hopefully would give people more clear guidance about how they would be applied.
And that's on page 1?
That's on page 1.
16 through
correct.
15.
Yeah. The next major thing that happens is on page 19 of the bill.
Bill.
19 of the original bill?
Yeah. And it's on page 18 of the B34 amendments. Line 19. Under the B and Gross bill, the section that limits gifts to $50 exempts judges and other public officials who serve the judicial department. This amendment limits that exemption and says that the gift limits do not apply to public officials who are subject to the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct. I believe that that means that judges would still be exempt under this, maybe even county judges in those counties that still have that style of government instead of a county commission. But it would not exempt people who work for the judicial department who are not subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why? Why are we exempting judges? And
I suspect that somebody from the judicial department could answer that better than I, but I believe it's because the Code of Judicial Conduct already has specific language and prohibitions and limits on judges accepting anything of value.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Is that more restrictive than we're doing, or is it more liberal?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, I don't know the answer to that question, but I believe there's somebody here from the Judicial Department who could probably help you with that.
In the back? Can we get an answer on that?
Sure. Would you like to come forward on that question? Good afternoon. Please identify yourself.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Nori Cross, special counsel to the State Court Administrator. The Code of Judicial Conduct, I can't say it's exactly coextensive with the provisions here. It is certainly more limited in a number of ways. There are some provisions that we've been concerned about how restrictive Senate Bill 10's language was because we thought it would be more restrictive than certain provisions in the Code of Judicial Conduct, specifically Judicial Rule 3-103, which provides or allows judges to accept invitations to certain activities that are related to law improvement activities, allows them to accept scholarships, and you know, do public service for law improvement purposes and legal education, and we thought the language in Senate Bill 10 was more restrictive. Mr. Rettlinger worked on language in House Bill 2598 that paralleled a lot of the provisions in the judicial rule 3-103. that we had requested both the chair of Senate Rules and the chair of this committee to consider to substitute for the language regarding gifts in Senate Bill 10. So I can't say it's completely more restrictive. Certainly the Code of Judicial Conduct prohibits even the appearance of impropriety and provides that judges can be disciplined for that. So in that respect, it is much more restrictive.
Yeah, Representative Berger, go ahead.
So in 2598, there was language that mirrored the Code of Judicial Conduct with regard to gifts.
Yes, and it would have applied, excuse me, I'm sorry,
no, go on.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, it would have applied those provisions to all public officials and not merely to judges.
But that, excuse me, Madam Chair, but that language is not the same as in here.
It is not. The B34s have some additional provisions that are paralleled, such as removing the word unsolicited from the informational materials, so that there are some parallel provisions, but I haven't, I guess, had time really to digest the B34s to make the comparisons to see how coextensive they are.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you. I would just think, especially in terms of the appearance of impropriety, that having us pass a bill where the summary says exempts judges or public officials serving judicial department from gift limits, I would think that would raise a huge red flag in terms of, I mean, in terms of the judges that you serve wanting to have full appearance of impropriety. I don't know how to get around it.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, and I agree. You know, we live in a fishbowl in the judicial branch, as you do. That's not the kind of headline that we certainly want to see. But there were other recognitions in the Oregon Law Commission's bills that various professions are subject to other codes of conduct that are sometimes as restrictive or more restrictive than the Chapter 244 provisions. Senate Bill 494, I believe it was, on conflict of interest, had a specific provision that essentially exempted judges, but the way that it wrote it was that if a judge was subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct, and not all judges are, municipal judges are not, then those judges were to follow the Code of Judicial Conduct rather than follow the provisions, the conflict of interest provisions in 494. So that there are different ways of looking at it. You know, that summary makes it look as, or makes it sound as though judges are not subject to the limits or ethical limits at all, whereas in fact we have at least as high a standard, if not a higher standard, in the Code of Judicial Conduct, and judges can be removed from office for violating those rules of conduct.
And this may help, although I can't. I think most of this work did take place on the Senate side. I know that I received a visit from those representing the Judicial Department saying that judges, and I know as originally drafted, Senate Bill 10 applies not just to judges, but every
yes.
employee of the Judicial Department. I don't think that was the intent. But the comments that I got when I was visited by judges were that they do need to travel to events in their official capacity and appear at various kinds of meetings that they felt they would be prohibited from doing as part of their professional activities if these limits did apply to them. And so I'm assuming that that was how the exemption got carved out on the Senate side, was in order to allow that to proceed. Is that your recollection?
In part, let me supplement that, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. The gift provisions in Senate Bill 10 follow almost word for word the provisions in Colorado Amendment 41 that was passed last November. and it created an immediate sort of firestorm in Colorado because of how the limits played out for various public officials. That amendment expressly excluded the Colorado judicial branch, and when we visited with the chair of the Senate Rules Committee and with the chair of this committee, and we submitted a letter February 21st with some information about that amendment and about the exemption for the judicial branch. We were not asking to be exempted. We did ask for both committees to consider adopting the gift definitions in 2598, House Bill 2598, in lieu of the gift provisions in Senate Bill 10. And when we were asked what the law was in Colorado, we informed the chairs that Colorado had exempted the judicial branch. The judicial branch in Colorado got a legal opinion saying that, yes, it was very clear in Colorado Amendment 41 that the judicial branch was exempted. And so we were told, well, you know, that's maybe the cleanest way to deal with it, because I think there was some concern whether the language in 2598 was going to meet the needs of the proponents of Senate Bill 10.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you. It does just strike me as strange that we've got, and you're right, Madam Chair, the concerns with the bill as it came over from the Senate, in this provision, where we've got, you know, rules that are applying from everybody from the governor down to a fire district commissioner, and yet we take one group, and, I mean, actually the language you referenced from the other bill that said they're included, but in cases where a specific higher standard may need to be applied because of their specific circumstances, that's I think it's legitimate to accommodate where there are specific needs that may be unique to the judicial branch. It does just strike me as strange, and I think a real PR problem for judges, frankly, for us to just straight exempt them out. But I may stand alone on that, which is fine. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Just quick response. I'm comforted by the fact that municipal judges who are not subject to the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct would be covered by this bill. I appreciate that information. And Madam Chair White, while we do have this subject brought up, if I can ask a question in reference to the Colorado Amendment 41 information that you provide, Representative Esquivel, and maybe Ms. Relator would know this. Is there any concern that the provisions, the gift provisions of Senate Bill 10 would make it impossible for a child of an elected official to accept a scholarship from a private foundation? That seems to be an issue that's been brought up. I'm just wondering if you have any reaction to that. I hope we can get on the record that that's not the legislative intent. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is an issue that's come up in Colorado, as you know. I do not think, well, first of all, this provision is statutory, and in Colorado I believe there was a constitutional amendment, which makes it difficult to change. Second, I do not think a scholarship offered to the child of a public official would be prohibited by this unless somebody decided to give a scholarship to that child simply because they were the child of a public official. If they did that, clearly the intent would be to, you know, for some reason, either to develop a relationship with the public official for some other reason. But if it was offered in the ordinary course of business without regard to the public official status of the child's parent, then I do not believe it would be covered or prohibited by this bill or subject to the $50 limit.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So are there any other questions for Ms. Cross while she's up here? Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification. Okay, Ted, I'm not sure where we interrupted.
We're almost
you,
done. we're on page 18 of the B34 amendments, which amend the bottom of page 20 of the B engrossed bill. The Senate Bill 10 amendments require some reporting by public officials on a quarterly basis. in the bill right now, if a public official receives travel expenses for a trip that's paid for by a nonprofit or some other unit of government, the public official has to report that. Just like now, if you receive food, lodging, and travel expenses to go someplace, you have to report that on your statement of economic interest with the GSPC. The bill carries that same theory over. It changes the reporting to quarterly. The B-34 amendments also add the trips that are allowed for reasonable food, lodging, and travel for the trade promotion and fact-finding missions and negotiations. Those were left out of reporting, I believe, inadvertently. They're now in with all of the other trips that are allowed.
And that this would make them reportable, just not prohibited, but reportable.
Correct. The, Madam Chair, this simply requires that they be reported. The next major change is on page 21 of the B-34s. It's a new section. It's taken word for word from House Bill 2594, which was an Oregon Law Commission bill. And what it does is prohibit public officials.
Members, we're on page 21 of the Dash 34 Amendment, starting at the top of the page. I think we're talking about section 23A.
Section 23A, page 21, line 2. This comes from 2594. It says that a public official for 2 years after they cease being a public official may not have a direct financial interest in a public contract that that public official negotiated while they were a public official, or that was negotiated and entered into by a body of which the public official was a member. So it limits the ability of people to negotiate contracts while their public officials then leave office and somehow obtain personal financial gain from that particular contract.
And members, that was a provision that the Law Commission asked to have included in this bill because it didn't. It actually was originally in the Law Commission bill, which had a revolving door prohibition for state legislators. And although we adopted a bill that did that, and this bill also adopts a bill that does that, those other provisions didn't get included.
Madam Chair, member, the final major change is on page 22 of the B-34 amendments, line 20. This modifies the sections on the legal expenses trust fund, which is all new material. What it does is change the reasons that a public official can establish a legal expenses trust fund. The bill, as printed, simply says that a public official may establish a fund to pay expenses that are incurred in connection with a legal proceeding that arises from the course and scope of duties of the person as a public official, which would in theory cover both offensive and defensive legal actions. What the amendments do is limit that and say that you can use a legal expenses trust fund for legal expenses incurred in connection with various protective stalking orders that a public official might need to obtain, and secondly, with defending the public official in any proceeding or investigation that's brought or maintained by a public body against that public official. So it really says you can use it for defensive purposes, or you can use it for any purpose relating to protective stalking orders.
And while we're talking about this, Representative Berger just pointed out to me the Dash B-35 amendments, which, Ted, I don't know if you have those in front of you, but they relate to this same section of the bill. And they appear to be identical to what you just described, with the addition of a new parentheses F added on to the section that also says seeking affirmative relief in a collateral proceeding related to a proceeding or investigation threatened, brought, or maintained against the public official by a public body as defined in ORS 174.109. Can you describe what that language does?
There are others who could probably explain their intent better than I, but as I understand it, this would cover a situation where a public body is threatening or has instigated legal action against a public official, and the public official would like to pursue injunctive relief, for example, in a court. In other words, take some offensive action that's connected with the same lawsuit or the same legal proceedings.
So would that be something like filing legal action against the Government Standards and Practices Commission to...
I suppose
we can have the Attorney General come up and talk about this. And actually, since we're talking about it, why don't we do that right now? Phil Schradl, please come forward.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. With the version that came to you in the Dash 34s, Mr. DiLorenzo raised a question that I think is a legitimate question. We tried to deal with those in the Dash 35s. And there are proceedings that one can assert, and actually under the Administrative Procedures Act itself, there's a provision entitled ORS 183-480 sub 3. And if a public official or someone else suggests that an agency is proceeding without probable cause, the way to establish that would be to go into circuit court and establish that there wasn't any basis for the action to proceed. It was unclear to us from the way the language came to you whether that is a defensive mechanism or whether it is outside the scope of what the Legal Expense Trust Fund was set up to do under the old provisions. And we thought that was appropriate to add that in so that if somebody in reaction to the action that was undertaken by the administrative body wanted to try and stop that very same proceeding, that we wanted to just make sure that the language was broad enough to include that. So the intent here was to provide the nexus between F would be available only when the sub E, there was some action or proceeding that was initiated by the GSPC in this example. And so the language is just to mirror that so that the public official could see what we weren't sure was a defensive posture or an offensive posture. And that was the intent.
So are you saying that this language was meant to modify E here?
Chair Rosenbaum, it would be available in relation to the proceeding that would be being pursued in E. If there are two things that the public official could do. If the Government Standards and Practices Commission initiated an enforcement action against a public official, the Legal Expense Trust Fund could be used to fund the defense in the GSPC proceeding. If part of that defense was to attempt to go to circuit court and establish that the agency is proceeding without probable cause at all, it was unclear whether the E language was broad enough to cover that as a Legal Expense Trust Fund item. And we just wanted to make sure that there was language that would authorize the public official to use the Legal Expense Trust Fund in that circumstance as well.
But this language appears to me to also allow you to go to court to also stop an investigation from going forward.
Chair Rosenbaum, I think the language is broad enough to do that. I think there would be an ability already existing under ORS 183-480 sub 3 for a public official to go to circuit court to attempt to stop even the investigatory matters. And there'd have to be a legal basis for that kind of a claim. The question here isn't whether that would be a meritorious claim or not, but whether the Legal Expense Trust Fund monies could be used for that purpose. Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Schradl? Okay, thank you very much for that clarification.
Madam Chair, members, that's the only other thing that's happening in this amendment is a host of complicated conflict amendments, which are designed to make House Bill 2595, which this committee sent out long ago, work with Senate Bill 10. What they're designed to do is take sections where both this bill, Senate Bill 10 and 2595, amend the same section or the same subject, mold them together in a way that works and that carries forward the goals of Senate Bill 10. I have to tell you that these amendments are drafted to the majority report of House Bill 2595, which is scheduled to be heard by the Senate this evening with a minority report. It would work best with this bill if House Bill 2595 cleared the system before Senate Bill 10, because it's drafted in that order. If the order gets reversed, then we're going to have to do something different.
Well, I see no way this bill could pass before that bill passes, since we do not even have a floor session today, but you never know around here, so I think that's a good point. Yes, Representative.
I think the one thing we need to make sure, since 2595 is going to come by for concurrence, I think he's saying we need to make sure we concur on that before we even pass this.
Or consider adopting this.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, that would be the preferred option.
Yeah. Okay, so there obviously are a lot of conforming changes in here, but they do not make any substantive change.
No, Madam Chair, in the time that I had to look at them, I went through them with both bills. They seem to me to clearly and correctly resolve the conflicts between the two bills without making substantive changes that you have not already seen either in that bill or in this bill with these amendments.
Okay, so questions for Mr. Ruttlinger?
Well, I'm not sure if the drafter is the right person to ask this, but page 18, Ted.
Of the amendment?
Of the amendment. The entertainment language, the prohibition on entertainment. It has been put to me that this would bar, for instance, my husband, who has at times an administrative or an interest, he being a public official as I am, although a volunteer, from buying me a trip to the movies.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not sure that's true, because the exemptions from the definition of gift specifically exempt gifts from relatives, and a spouse does fit within that definition.
Okay, and
so that, I mean, that's true under current law. That would continue to be true under this bill.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
If I could just follow up on that, and this may be just a term of art, is in that same reference, page 18, line 3, which says any gift of payment of expenses for entertainment. The fact that gift is used there means that that would still then be subject to that gift exemption back on page 13. There's not gift of payment of expenses is not a different term of art than just gift.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, I used that language to make it clear that we were in fact talking about gifts as defined here, because the incidental entertainment that is okay to receive and the ceremonial entertainment that's okay to receive are specifically exempted from the definition of gift. And so that's, as a matter of drafting, that's how I accomplished that goal. So, yes, it would technically be considered a gift. Those two things would be exempted from the definition of gift. And then back on page 17, on line 30 of the bill, it says, notwithstanding subsection 1 of this section, and that refers to the $50 gift limit in section 18. And so taken together, what it means is, basically what it means is that even though there's a $50 limit on all gifts, you can't get a gift of entertainment unless it's one of those two exemptions.
Got it. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Ruttlinger? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you. And this is maybe to someone else that would have a better answer, but on page 14 of the dash 34, whatever, B34, in a small I, it's another one of those exemptions, in association with the final review, approval, execution, documents, and so on. In final review, the issue would have to do with regard to ports, with regard to fire districts, with regard to others, where you have people going out to buy some new equipment, and a different equipment company says, look, we've got this in Texas, we've got this in, another company says they got it in New York, so we'll fly you to look at it because it's hard to bring it to you in the initial stages. That would be not appropriate, if I understand this right. In the final approval, it would be okay. But what if you went, looked, and decided you didn't want to at the final, and therefore it was not the final any longer, because you would open up the process again? Did you break the rules by accepting to go look at it at the final when it turned out not to be the final? So I'm worried about whether we should have final in there. I mean, I think most people go to these things to find out if it's going to work, and if it's going to work in their situation. And oftentimes they won't bring the stuff there. In a port, they don't bring the crane there. You know, you go look at a crane in action somewhere. And oftentimes those companies will bring you. I mean, it's a big deal. So I worry about this in those associations, whether that would preclude them from finding out the information they need to do the best job to make a selection. And I guess my definition of final means you've got to be, I've already gone through almost everything else.
Madam Chair, Representative Roman, I think you're correct. I think the word final does narrow the scope and application of this particular exemption. If you took out the word final, clearly it would cover any food and beverage expenses that are received by a public official in connection with any review, approval, or execution of documents, not simply the final review.
And so in some of those instances, I think that's important. That's what makes me nervous.
And, Ted, this language is in Senate Bill 10B, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Madam Chair, this language is in the current bill. It's on page 15, line 22. If my memory serves me, the original language was limited to the State Treasurer's Office. It was then expanded to various other intergovernmental relationships and relationships with private entities. However, the word final stayed in.
So, I mean, from my perspective, for certain groups that are out there doing their job, this would be an impediment to getting the best decisions made.
Yes, Representative Penn on this point.
Thank you. Because I actually think applying to the treasurer, I think, makes perfect sense because there's no, I mean, anything that's paperwork can be communicated electronically or telephonically. There shouldn't be any early trips for those kind of things. I think the only application I can envision that would be a problem would be where you've got some fire truck, some container crane, something that cannot be transmitted electronically or telephonically. That's where I think the application of it to the treasurer makes, or to other paperwork kind of documents, makes perfect sense. I'm just concerned about the narrowing of it when we're dealing with equipment, big equipment. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask?
Yes, Representative Brevin, follow up.
That small I, does that only involve food and beverage?
Madam Chair, Representative Roland, yes.
So the travel section is H.
Correct. H, and up above it on the previous page, F would also allow travel.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley?
In the context of this conversation, would a fact-finding mission cover what Representative Roblin is talking about if someone needs to fly to observe a crane in action in order to verify it be right for their port, would that come under the definition of fact-finding mission?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, it seems to me that it would because you are going on a trip to determine whether or not this piece of equipment satisfies the needs of your public body.
Madam Chair, the fact-finding statement is on line 8, page 14.
So I think that...
That's already okay. That one's fine. So
yeah,
it's just the good... All we're really talking
for
about...
For food, travel, lodging expenses in conjunction with fact-finding. Or now this new language is officially designated negotiations with advance approval. That seems like it would cover a variety of situations, including the one that's been described here.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Buckley?
If I can ask, on page 13 of the 1934's section F, this is a area where I think the most questions come up from my colleagues in terms of expenses paid for attendance at a convention, fact-finding mission, or trip, or other meeting if the public official is scheduled to. Here we go on lines 28 and 29. Deliver a speech, make a presentation, participate on a panel, or represent state government. Am I correct in assuming that that the rules will define what exactly that means? Because the question comes up is, if I attend a conference and I stand up and say, I introduce myself, does that qualify as a speech? Or by attending a conference with Representative Esquivel in Medford, are we representing state government because the two of us are at a luncheon that has to do with affordable housing, issue like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, first part of your question is yes, I think the GSPC would probably be adopting rules on this general subject. Second, to answer your question, as long as you are attending one of these functions in your capacity as a state representative, it seems to me that you are there representing state government. That's the hook. If you're there as a state representative, then you are there in your official capacity.
Even with Representative Esquivel.
It's in Medford. He's buying.
Yes, Representative Berger.
This gets tricky real fast, Ted. You're always a state representative when you get up in the morning, and you also go to meals and events. This in your official capacity. My Chamber of Commerce, for instance, does the Crystal Apple Awards banquet to honor all educators every year. If I go, am I acting in official capacity? And the entertainment is incidental. I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, an event like that could be covered under the reception exemption, which is added.
Where is that?
On page 15 of the amendment, line 2, we cover the food and beverage that you experience at that reception. If you went to something like the Crystal Apple reception and were to speak or as in your official capacity, would be covered under big E on page 13, which allows admission and food and beverage at meetings where you appear to answer questions or make some sort of presentation, or you're part of the program.
So is it big E?
Page 13.
But if I'm not speaking, then I...
If you're not speaking, you're not going to be subject to that exemption. That's correct.
So I basically...
Pay
my own way. To a dinner, yeah, that you're not a speaker.
Madam Chair, that's right. Unless, of course, you can fit within this reception... The food and beverage would be okay if it fits within the reception exemption.
And that is L.
L. On page 15.
And if the dinner did not exceed the $50 threshold, from that single source, then that would also be allowable under...
Madam Chair, that's correct.
...this new language. I mean, the language that's been there in Senate Bill 10.
Yes.
As long as they didn't have two such meetings.
Yeah, and if my husband came with me, then, yeah, this is very constraining.
Okay, other questions for Mr. Rettlinger?
If we can just finish off with Representative Berger's point there, then if Representative Berger's husband did attend that particular function and said the tickets were $50 each, and pretending that your husband was not a public official of any kind, so it was just you and a non-public official spouse, would Representative Berger at that point, would her husband have to pay that $50 in order to attend that function with her in the scenario that we're talking about with the crystal dinner?
Crystal apple dinner?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, the gift limits in this bill apply both to the public official and to relatives of the public official, and each person has a $50 aggregate per year limit from a single source. So it would be permissible for a public official and the spouse to accept a gift up to $50, but not over. And if the gift was $50, then you would be finished with gifts from that source for the rest of the calendar year.
Thank you. If I could follow.
Yes.
If the tickets were $75, if Representative Berger and her husband thought, well, we'll kick in the extra $25, that would be perfectly permissible.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I believe that the answer to that is yes. I'm not entirely positive, but the bill does set a $50 limit. And as long as you don't receive more than $50 from a single source, I believe it would be permissible for you to make up the rest.
Thank you.
And I think the other point to be made here, and this really isn't new, but my understanding, and we can get Ron Burson to explain this if we need to, but is that these limits, as well as the ones that are in the law right now, apply to the actual value of the dinner part of a ticket to an event. And what is generally the case is that a lot of events for charitable organizations have a much higher ticket price than the actual cost of the dinner. That cost of the dinner is included in the price of the ticket. The rest is generally just a charitable donation to that organization. And so, yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, my problem is, and the reason that I picked that particular event, is that it is not sponsored by a charitable organization. It is sponsored by my Chamber of Commerce. And let me give you another example. I maybe picked that one wrongly. I'm a former First Citizen of Salem, honored by the Chamber of Commerce, and every year they give a banquet in honor of First Citizens. And I presume from now on, my husband and I both have to pay our way to that because we are honorees, but we're not honorees. And I can guarantee it's more than $50 a bite. And that is not a nonprofit. It's a local. There's 1,000 such organizations. But from now on, if I want to go, unless I'm asked to speak, and if I'm asked to speak, it doesn't matter. My husband still has to pay.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, keep in mind that this bill carries over the existing definition of a gift in the statute. And what the definition of gift says is that it covers gifts that are given to public officials on terms that are not extended to people who are not public officials. In other words, if it's something that the gift giver will give to anybody, regardless of whether they're a public official or not, then it's not a gift under this definition. This definition covers things which are given to people because they're public officials. So if you are selected as the first citizen of Salem simply because of your good works, and it's arguably unrelated to your status as a public official at this time, I mean, you haven't received this award simply because you're a member of the legislature, then arguably it's not a gift and it's not subject to this definition and this limit. Obviously, each one of those would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis.
Representative Roblin.
I'm going to go down this line just a little bit. We're at the Golden Apple Awards, and they have decided they have extra money, and they want to honor a teacher for outstanding work in Salem. And so part of the deal will be the teacher is going to receive a $500 award. for being an outstanding teacher for Salem. Can that teacher accept that?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, under existing law and under the B. Engrossed bill, yes, because unsolicited tokens or awards of appreciation are exempt. This bill, these amendments, add to that a limit on a $25 resale value. So it would, again, you'd have to figure out the answer to that question on a case-by-case basis, depending upon what sort of item, token, plaque, gift was given to the public official. If it was under $25 resale value, then it would be okay.
So they could not give that. They could not accept a $500 cash gift.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, not under the B-34 amendments, no.
And I don't know that they could right now, actually.
That's true.
Representative Hunter,
Just looping back to this, because I think the as the chair said, the application of the value on a dinner, for instance, would be the actual value of that dinner, whether that was for a nonprofit or a for-profit. I mean, even if this dinner happens to be for a for-profit entity, the value of the dinner, presumably, is still not going to be more than $50. And so, whether that was a nonprofit or a for-profit, I think the elected official would still be. I mean, if the value was over $50, clearly it'd be excluded.
Madam Chair, I think you're right. The only point in these exemptions where the nonprofit status makes a difference is for purposes of paying for reasonable travel, other expenses to go to conventions and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions for Legislative Council? Not at this time. thank you again very much for all the hard work that has gone into this area. Okay. You wanted to talk about the B-32?
Yeah, could we have the Law Commission? Because there's some very good stuff in there. It adds some language around that was sort of neglected, like where it says public official and they've left out things like member of households.
Okay. Well, would the Oregon Law Commission like to come up and talk about the -B-32 amendments? Members, you should have a copy of the -B-32.
Yes.
And Ted, I see that you are still here, and I really appreciate that, because there may be questions that arise about how these various amendments interface with each other. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. The B-32 amendments are, as Vice Chair Berger explained, mostly cleanup amendments and some substantive changes that were in other bills that haven't been blended into either Senate Bill 10 or our House Bill 2595. Those are the two ethics bills now as they have emerged. 2595 is now combining about three or four bills, and Senate Bill 10 combines several other bills that were originally recommended by the Law Commission. Senate Bill 10 now has many provisions that were not recommended by the Law Commission, and in fact the Law Commission would not support them. But the -32s are issues that were in neither bill that were consensus amendments by the Law Commission and the work group that we didn't want to lose in this process. They weren't selected out to be put into either bill. They're largely regarding Chapter 171, the lobbyist reporting provisions. Those weren't really folded into either bill. The first, I'd be happy to go through the entire amendment if that's what you'd like.
That would be great.
The first, the page two amendments fix the funding scheme. Basically, state government is charged on a per capita FTE, and local governments would be charged an additional fee on their municipal audit fee. The way it came over from the Senate was that volunteers would be counted, and it wasn't clear how that actually worked, and so this deletes volunteers.
I think that's actually taken care of in the amendments that we just went through.
Yes.
Yeah.
Section 6, 6A, and yeah, 6A, just clarify executive official lobbying. There are many provisions in 244 and 171 that suggest the GSPC has jurisdiction over people who lobby the executive branch for legislative action, but there are opinions suggesting that there wasn't the right authority in how lobbying was defined, and so this cleans up that lobbying does cover people who lobby executive officials as it relates to legislative action.
And I'm sorry, Wendy, I didn't quite follow. So who are these class of people that aren't currently covered by the law?
It's not clear that people who lobby, for example, the governor or DHS with respect to legislative action, whether they're clearly covered. And there are a couple of cleanups that make that happen in Section 6 and 6A. Parts of it are consistent already in Senate Bill 10, but this clarifies a couple other places.
Executive officials or...
This is on page 2 and 3 of the 32s. Then Section 6B clarifies who is required to register. It clarifies the 24-hour rule. It also clarifies who does not have to register and adds to the list of who does not have to register based on how legal titles are provided now for the governor's office and the treasurer's office. It also adds the law commission staff. We have a legislative opinion that suggests that we do not have to register, but it's not really clear in law. We're created by the legislative branch to assist the legislature. It's not clear what our role is in terms of registration. 6C is a cleanup. And on to page 5 of how the 24-hour rule works and who has to file when you already are registered, and adding new clients and adding pro bono clients. We're just clarifying that language of how those reports have to be done.
So could you say something more about that? That's not an issue I've heard raised previously.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, it's just not clear what triggers. You're already registered for one client and you pick up another client. Does the 24-hour rule start again? Of whether you have to now register for that client, or because you're already registered, you immediately need to register. It wasn't clear, and so this clarifies that. It also clarifies if you pick up another client and it's you're not being paid for that client, whether you have to register with the GSPC for that client.
And so how does it address that situation?
On page 4, sub 3, you have to file a separate registration form, as I understand it, right away, within 3 days, which is how most people have interpreted it to mean. Once you're registered, you need to register within 3 days for new clients. But on sub 4, if you're not compensated, the 24-hour rule does apply. Or you spend more than $100, so you can help you can help for a short amount of time for pro bono work and not have to register right away.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, if I can ask you, hopefully it's an obvious question. Forgive me if it's an ignorant one. When he talks about representing a person, that's distinct from representing a business entity. Or is that inclusive of a business entity?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, my understanding is the way person is defined in the ORS elsewhere, it's an expansive definition to include business organizations, associations, but Ted can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
All right. He's not going to say it. Thank you.
Then the next set of changes clarify the report the lobbyist actually must file. Right now it's a complicated report that requires listing of phone bill expenses and other things that really folks at the Law Commission decided that we really just care about how much you're spending. We don't really need to itemize and try to figure out, well, you know, I have a law business and I do some lobbying, you know, just a total would work. And so we've clarified that reporting form be in lines 17, 23, and deleting 25 through 28. I just made that a simpler form. Page 3 of the bill, of Senate Bill 10B.
Page 3. And what page of the amendment are you on?
Page 5. Okay. It's at the amendments are starting at lines 25 to 30 on page 5 of the amendments. Basically, it's we require a total amount of all monies expended for food, refreshments, and entertainment by the lobbyist, and will not require a total for each one of food, printing, advertising, and miscellaneous.
So in other words, you could lump all of your expenses for food, refreshments, and entertainment together.
Won't be any entertainment.
Good point.
Only incidentally.
Payments out.
They're itemized here.
Chair Rosenbaum, that's current law that there are these totals, but then there's also a specific you have to list itemized if it's over $50. And so there still would be an itemization if food or beverage or entertainment, if that's kept in, was for a specific public official, that would still be itemized. So it's lumping your general office expenses together, but it's still requiring an itemization for specific public officials. It's also taking out the CPI that keeps changing that $50. In Senate Bill 10, that the CPI is taking out the cost of living. It keeps changing, and so we want to keep lobbyists and public officials on the same track, and so it would delete out sub 2, which is line 36 through 40 of Senate Bill 10 as well.
Oh, that does a CPI.
Right.
Okay, we don't want that. It's straight 50.
Right. We don't want to have some stuff moving in.
No, I see the exception.
On page 6 of the 32s, again, it's changing the lobbyist report, clarifying how those work. And then it also, on page 7, it would add to Senate Bill 10 that if there was a violation found by the GSPC by a lobbyist, there would be a report to the Assembly. Keep in mind that lobbying, as it's defined by the GSPC statutes, is that lobbying applies to those people who lobby the legislature or lobby the executive branch. Presently, you have rules that allow you to discipline lobbyists, but there's nothing in statute that connects that finding to the legislature, and so this would add a new provision to actually give notice to the Assembly of lobbyists who have been found in violation. Then there are many fixes to relative and member of the household. Presently, Chapter 244 is sort of circular. Relative is defined as how you might guess, brothers, sisters, parents, spouses, and such. And then member of household is defined as relative. And so people who are living together who aren't legally married or have other significant others living in their house are not really included by the definition of member of the household, and so there's been times where that the limits don't apply to those folks, nor do the exceptions that permit certain gifts, and so we're clarifying that throughout. Some of those changes already were made in Senate Bill 10, and these amendments would make that consistent. So the definition would be for relative to be the spouse, the domestic partner, the public official, any children, siblings, spouses of siblings or parents, any individual for whom the public official has a legal support obligation, or any individual for whom the public official provides benefits arising from their public employment. So that's kind of the group of who would be traditionally considered your relative. I think that's all the substantive changes that there are.
And did you present these suggestions to the Senate when they were considering this bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, the Law Commission had 10 bills that were recommended. 5 were filed in the House and 5 were filed in the Senate. Then Senate Bill 10 was filed in addition to those. We had sort of understood that those 10 bills would move, but ultimately those 10 did not. And so the Law Commission did not actually testify in really support or opposition of Senate Bill 10 at the time it was heard, because we were waiting for the Law Commission's bills. That's the awkward position the Law Commission is in, of recommending legislation and not really touching other bills. We provided our best shot at how to improve these ethics laws. So we did not advocate for adding more things into Senate Bill 10 at that time. And so nor did we criticize or, you know, recommend changes to Senate Bill 10 at the time. So there were numerous hearings on Senate Bill 10, but we didn't really have the authority because the Law Commission recommended our 10 bills, not Senate Bill 10, so we did not really testify on Senate Bill 10 except to explain what it did. They didn't really provide any additions. So as I said, Senate Bill 10 essentially was cherry-picked pieces that are identical to some of the Law Commission's provisions, but some conflict.
And Madam Chair, yes, so you understand the Law Commission came to me after Senate Bill 10 had come out and said they saw some clear clarifications that would really improve and help the bill. And that's without changing substantive things, but trying to make it clear, particularly in this lobbying section, some clear things they saw that would help clarify the language, make it more consistent, and make this lobbying thing more workable, more in line with their original suggestions. That is the provenance of it, and I said, go ahead and get them drafted.
Okay, that's fine. And I think if we are going to consider these amendments, we probably should hear from the GSPC about the lobbying provisions to see if they... Yes, Representative Beckley.
I just wanted to ask him that prior in your testimony, you mentioned that there were some provisions in Senate Bill 10 the Law Commission would not support. Would you be so kind as to briefly mention what those provisions would be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, sure. They're the provisions that most people are confused and concerned about how they're going to apply to their lives. It's the TRIPS and the food and beverage provisions. The Law Commission made a concerted effort to go down the route of more reporting, more frequent reporting. We looked at whether you could really try to define what types of travel, food and beverage expenses you could codify, mm-hmm. that would make it easy for people to follow, and how you could restrict it. It didn't make a lot of sense, as the commissioners discussed it, of how to really say, out-of-state trips aren't okay. If it's an environmental education trip and it happens to be in New York, is that any different than if it's in Oregon? Defining who gave that trip, private or a nonprofit or a public entity, all those folks have legislative administrative interests, and so we struggled with how to restrict it, and the commission, although not unanimous at the worker level, decided to try out more reporting, let the people decide, and then maybe go back and restrict more if needed. But we did not restrict food, lodging and travel or food and beverage. We left the food and beverage in the presence of the giver, and we also left travel, but required more participation. You couldn't actually just show up and not really participate. You had to either be registered or otherwise be on the agenda. Required a little more participation, but we focused on more reporting, more frequent reporting, and making the reporting the same for lobbyists and the public officials so that the public could look on it on the internet and that they were the same. So we didn't have, and we actually added auditing authority to the GSPC so that they could actually check the lobbyist report and a public official report and see if they matched, which would give them more authority than simply relying on the public to complain or the media to complain, that they could actually audit. So that's how we would have fixed the issues of food and lodging and travel.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for the Law Commission? Yes, Representative Roblin.
As we heard in the 34s, there were a lot of, the last half of the 34s were all making it line up with the previous bill as passed. Are there issues with 32s with regard to making it compliant with the other bill we passed and with 34s?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, I think that's a Ted Rittlinger question. Anytime you change a statute in one bill, it mixes up the other one.
Conforming ones, yeah. That,
yeah.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
Yeah, I would like to point out that the 32s are concerned with the lobbying and with language clarification. Right. They aren't part of the gift and entertainment.
Right.
I won't say debacle, but the gift and entertainment piece here. The 32s are more concerned with cleaning up and making clear the language about lobbying reporting, and also getting in that relatives and members of households is in there a lot, because it's clarifying and conforming all of that.
that's the only one that would make me concerned, because if we have a different definition of relatives and families, then we would need some more conforming language.
We got lots of time to work on this.
That's right, I know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until whatever time the committee wishes to adjourn this evening. Okay, so any other questions for the law commission? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I have had a request from a committee member to hear from Annette Price about the effect of Senate Bill 10 on state and local government economic development activities. So would you like to come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Price. I am the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and we have a concern about the B-34 amendments, how it specifically relates not just to our agency but to other ports around the state and perhaps state agencies that engage in economic development activity, or how we would look at it in customer relations with current businesses that operate at, for example, at the Port of Portland, whether it's our aviation or marine clients, as we do business with those entities. Many of you have thankfully enjoyed travel with some of our airline partners, and keeping those relationships, for example, keeping them at the Port of Portland and the destinations that we so choose to travel to in a direct flight manner. Those are relationships that we must maintain in not a traditional sense as we look at it as a government agency, but more as a public agency engaged in business activities, which we certainly are, and other ports around the state are as well. And I appreciate Representative Roeland and Representative Hunt's comments about the term final on page 14, line 12. We also would have some concern and would look to you, Madam Chair. We would be happy to work with you on getting some language that is not as broadly defined. We did have language in the B and Gross that has been removed from the B-34s, the on other official business that has, as I believe, been determined to be a little bit too broad. However, we would look to try to come up with language that was less broad to apply to organizations such as port state agencies, perhaps local governments at your direction, that would allow us to conduct our business in manner that is that we do currently, which is different from a traditional government entity. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if you'd like for me to offer up some language, or council has sent me some language, or if you would just rather wait, if we could work on that with legislative council.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Ms. Bessie, in the interest of time, would the deletion of the word final in on page 14, line 12 of the dash 34s, would that give you what you think you need in order to do business?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is one step. No, it would not give us all that we would need. My counsel has recommended would be on adding a new sub on page 14 after line 23, a new IV, which would include the language, while engaged in economic development activity on behalf of a state government as defined in ORS 174111, or a local government as defined in 174116.
Class 117, that too.
Yeah. And that was as it were. Madam Chair, Representative Rowland, yes, sir.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. And that would address, I think, our concerns as well as the concerns of other entities, as you all have heard.
I do appreciate that, Madam Chair. Yes. I can just respond in while we have Ms. Bessinger. My concern is that again opens a very wide door in terms of saying economic development. What we're trying to get away from is the appearance of deals being made because of gifts being given, and I'm afraid that opens a fairly wide door again to say economic development decisions might very well be based on the kind of goodies provided to those involved with public agencies in the negotiating process. I'm not casting aspersions on anyone. I'm just talking about the appearance of impropriety. So I don't know if you want to respond, but that's my concern with the language you just mentioned.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, we too have struggled with this. I mean, it to try to apply a certain standard to agencies such as ours who engage in commercial activity with customers, and we have found it to be very difficult. I spoke to Mr. Ruttlinger before committee and have engaged my counsel to try to come up with something again that narrowly defines, try to get right to it, it is a rather difficult task.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Could you read the proposed language that Representative Buckley was just talking about? Could you just read that one more time?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, again, it would add a new section IV to line after line 23 on page 14 of the B-34s. While engaged in economic development activity on behalf of a state government as defined in ORS 174111, a local government as defined in ORS 174116, or a special government as defined in ORS 174117.
I was counting on you to write that.
And perhaps Ms. Price could provide it to us.
Yes,
in writing.
This does just apply to food and beverage. It's not that huge a deal, but
no, it's not just food and beverage.
That section would be, yeah.
It's already exempted in the other ones.
That's true.
Yeah, that would only be food and beverage. That's true.
Yes, Representative
Penn,
thank you.
I'm just wondering, in response to Representative Buckley's concern, if there would be a way to just even add a couple of words to that, you know, to make it clear. I mean, you wouldn't want a port official out just using the excuse of economic development that really wasn't central to that port or to your port or to OECDD, maybe even just a couple of words talking about centrality to your statutory purpose, to OECD's statutory purpose, to
schools,
to whoever.
Specialist, yeah.
I wonder if that might tailor it a little bit. Yeah. The broadness of economic development coupled with statutory purpose. I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, I would certainly yield to Mr. Ruttlinger. I mean, another way to define it down further would be to cite the specific statute. The Port of Portland is in ORS 778. Ports generally are in 777. And there is another, let me see if I have that with me, language potentially. This is another suggestion. To make the exemption for food and beverage linked to agencies authorized to engage in economic development. Ports generally are identified in ORS 285A at 285A.600. So maybe that's another way to approach it, and adding, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, that language to the language that I've suggested.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, my problem with narrowing that down to ports is that cities engage in economic development on a regular basis. Counties engage in economic development. To narrow it down to ports is to constrain a whole series of governmental entities who daily and actively, gee, they eat and drink with folks who might bring jobs to their communities. We're getting to the point of ridiculousness here, in my opinion.
I guess my question is that the language that was in the original bill, which I thought did apply to the port dealing, I thought trade promotion, fact-finding missions, and then the language that you referred to that is deleted, but the other official business, which was the very broad one, those did apply?
Madam Chair, the very broad language did apply. My counsel has given me the opinion that the trade mission or fact-finding, as it specifically relates to the business activity that we engage in, not all trips that officials from the Port of Portland and other ports around the state are specifically identified as a trade mission or a fact-finding mission. We have instances where our executive director will visit one of our clients, customers in China, and again, it's a business relationship to continue, you know, make sure that we're doing what we need to be doing, and that we do not define as defined in the Bean Gross version of the bill, and that's why we added that other language.
And an overseas trip like that wouldn't be pursuant to trade promotion? It seems like by definition it would.
Madam Chair, that is the opinion that my counsel has given me. That's the reason why we needed to have the language added in the Bean Gross, and we are asking with the deletion of that language that we further, that we clarify that in terms of economic development, and I would yield to Mr. Ruttlinger how specifically to do that in statute. But we wanted to raise this as an issue because it remains an issue.
Representative Roblin.
And the other one that, you know, as I get into more of this that frustrates me is we have at our old high school a number of sister school relationships, Choshu Japan, Germany, England, and we send these students, no problem, but we send teachers with those students, and they have homestays, they have official little things where they go out and have dinner, and oftentimes all paid by the same organization, so they could have one meal, the $25 one, but you couldn't get that in Japan, a $25 meal, I don't think. But, I mean, they do all these things, and a club over in the other part, or a group, has organized for things, and they've raised money, and they provide all these things for that teacher and the others while they're there. And I'm not convinced right now that the teacher could accept that. They'd have to pay their own way. The kids could. I don't think there'd be any problem with that, but I don't want to stop some of those things because I see them in a whole lot of ways as being very positive things for us.
Yes, Representative Berger.
You can think of example after example. A call center for a ship company down in Eugene, the one that everyone sees on the freeway, that whatever, Royal Caribbean, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, they were looking to site that, and they came to Salem. And I was invited to dinner, my mayor was invited to dinner, and my community college president was invited to dinner to meet with those folks to talk about what Salem could put together in terms of training and siting for that facility. Well, Eugene got it. I didn't pay for that dinner. I don't know who did. But that's the kind of thing, that the kind of economic development activity that routinely happens at the local government level. And I just hope we're not writing something that says, I got to pay my way to that because I don't think I should have to, or my mayor should have to. There's just a lot of things where...
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could make another point. I mean, the business of not just the Port of Portland but other ports and entities in the state aren't necessarily, they're not all overseas. I mean, obviously, with airline carriers, and I saw one of my colleagues from one of the railroads come in, it is within this country. It's not, you know, again, it's not defined in a trade promotion as we traditionally would think. And the struggle that we've had is how you identify customer relations as trade promotions or a trade mission. And that's what we were trying to get at, perhaps too broadly, but just as important to allow ports, in my case, generally to conduct business with their current customers and prospective customers.
Okay, other questions for Ms. Price? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think, does the GSPC wish to make any comments on this at this point? Perhaps not unless we have questions for you. I think this might be a good time, since we've gotten a lot of information in the last hour and a half, for us to stand in recess. Or let's stand in recess until 4 o'clock. The committee is in recess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A number of us are having real difficulty understanding how, if it's somehow impermissible for us to make an expenditure of more than $50 a year for meals, beverages, gifts, whatever is in that bundle of services, why is it acceptable for us to make a substantial contribution to a legal defense fund? What's the policy rationale that differentiates those contributions? If we have a legislative and administrative interest in the work of you as public officials in this assembly, how do we justify making contributions when we're solicited to do that by you because you're needing a legal defense? Those are some of the concerns that we have overall with the structure. There are many things that are positive in Senate Bill 10. I think the work of the Oregon Law Commission, the work of legislative counsel has much to commend it. But I think in this area in particular, there will be many things left undone when this bill passes. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? Thank you. Okay. Members, we are in a work session, and I would ask unanimous consent to allow a conceptual amendment to be made to the amendments to this bill. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I think...
Madam Chair, point of inquiry. Do we need to move the dash B-34 amendments before we make conceptual changes to it, or do we need to change this first and then move?
Mr. Stembridge, do you have an answer to that?
Madam Chair, I would say as long as it's clear what's going out, I don't think it makes a difference in what order you take them. That would, starting with the dash 34 would be a good way to do it.
I think I would prefer to conceptually amend before we vote,
vote on the amendments.
Or even introduce them.
Okay. Okay, so let's start with the dash 34 amendments then. I'm not sure exactly in what form these motions should take place then. If we're not moving anything,
well,
I guess we just have made unanimous consent to adopt these changes. So,
could we ask Ramona to come down and advise us on this to get right?
We also have legislative counsel here in the room.
That's true. So, Ted, I suppose because we're going to be asking you to make all this work, maybe you'd like to come forward while we
sure don't mess it up.
While we butcher your work here, or hopefully not too much.
Okay.
So we are looking at the dash 34 amendment, and the first change, I guess the chair will just suggest these, is on page 14, on line 9, after the word negotiations, add the words for economic development activities.
And Madam Chair, how specific do you want to get on this? Because there is in the line above there is an or. Do you want to remove that or? Or do you want to let
I
Mr.
think
Reiner
that we can trust the legislative council to clean this up in terms of grammar
right here,
and form and style. Yes, Representative Hunt.
I would agree with that. The one thing I just want to make sure we're clear in terms of legislative intent that the phrase where receipt of the expenses is approved in advance only applies to the negotiations or economic development activities.
That's correct. And I
does
think
does not
that's
apply to trade promotion or fact finding missions.
That's the way it was drafted, correct? Okay. So that would be...
You want to leave that or then?
The first conceptual amendment to the dash 34s. Then, on line 12, to delete the word final, so that it would say in association with the review, approval, etc., of documents or And then I think the other change, Mr. Stambridge, you actually had citations for this, dealt with adding the ORS 174.117 that had been left out.
There are four locations that the term ORS 174.116 appears, and this amendment would add after that ORS the phrase, quote, or a special government body as defined in ORS 174.117, unquote.
Would it be helpful to just note those pages and line numbers so we're all clear?
The first instance is line 30 on page 13 of the dash B34. The second instance is on page 14, line 7. The third instance is on page 14, line 16. The fourth instance is on page 15 in line 10.
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
There may be other references in the existing bill, in the life phase print, in the printed bill. I just want to make sure that I have authorization to go through and find them all and change them consistent with your intent if we've missed something.
Yeah, if you find other places that we have missed, that would be part of our intent. Yes, Representative Roepland.
I just want to put on the record from my reading of, and we'll go back to page 14, when it says an officially sanctioned trade / promotion or fact-finding, that not only applies to, that sounds like business, but it also applies to cultural exchanges and those kinds of things. And so as we're writing definitions, that we make sure like the sister city agreements and those others are in that definition of what a trade or promotion, because to me, that's kind of what it is. We're both promoting ourselves back and forth and those kinds of things, and I think they should be included if people don't have any problems with that.
So I think that we've clearly stated that is our interpretation of this language, and I do see head nods from the Government Standards and Practices Commission that they interpret this language the same way that we do. Okay, so that is the Chair's proposal for conceptual amendments to the dash 34s. Is there Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, if you'd like a motion, I could move the dash 34 as conceptually amended to Senate Bill 10.
Representative Buckley moves the dash B34 amendment to Senate Bill 10 with the conceptual amendments. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Okay. Amendment is adopted. Yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I would like to propose B32 with the conceptual amendment to delete on page 5 the sub 4 that starts at line 5 and ends at line 11. The conceptual amendment is strictly a deletion of the entire. It is my understanding that GSBC considers this language too vague to be quite workable for them, and by just deleting it all together, it leaves the rest of the language in, and it doesn't. That's the reason.
Okay, so Representative Berger has moved a conceptual amendment to the dash 32s on page 5 to delete lines 5 through 11.
Right.
And the GSBC seems to be nodding that they are okay with that change.
So, Madam Chair, can I move the conceptually amended B32 amendments to Senate Bill 10?
Representative Berger moves the dash B32 amendments with the conceptual amendment into Senate Bill 10. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, I have a note from the conflicts section at Legislative Council that indicate the B32s may have conflicts And so you might want to also add to your motion that any conflicts that are found would be added.
I would willingly add to my motion that any conflicts certainly should be addressed appropriately and would have no problem with that. This, we are into some pretty complicated things here. And I would be surprised if we wouldn't find a conflict or two.
Yes.
As Ted well knows.
Okay. So I think we're assuming that with all these, you're going to have to resolve the conflicts.
There will be conflicts.
Okay. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. And Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 10 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Bill 10 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Isn't it Senate Bill 10B?
It is Senate Bill 10B as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, we have had 6 months of working on these issues. I am... And I had all interim working with the Law Commission on these issues. At this late date, we have come forward with a very complicated scheme here. I know how difficult this is. Having lived through the Law Commission work all last interim, I am bothered on two levels by this. One, I have never looked favorably on the local government paying piece. I think this is something that should come from general fund. I have also stood on that forever. If that were the only issue in here, I could probably support it, but I do not believe this language is clear. I don't think it's workable. I think it's based on some language in Colorado that has proven to be a disaster. I am not against ways to restrict and make clear the gifting and the feeding and the sort of inner workings of all of the parties involved. But I don't believe we've gotten there yet. Unfortunately, I can't support this bill.
Further discussion. Representative Esquivel.
I have to agree with my colleague from Salem. Not only that, but I want to state something here that I think we all need to remember in this room. If this bill passes, we'll be dealing with some unintended consequences. Just mark that down. This is very complex. In my opinion, it was well intended, but I think it's very convoluted.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my thoughts on this. I think the public expects ethics reform from this legislature after the series of articles that appeared in the paper in the past year or so. We have an obligation to clean up the image of this institution and strongly make a statement that we expect the business of the legislature to be above board. The rules of the House this session, there's been a lot of teasing about the rules of the House, but I don't think anybody has particularly suffered under the rules of the House of this session. These laws that are put in place with Senate Bill 10 will be reviewed. We'll make changes with them as we go along, but I think it's absolutely essential that we make this effort. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think Representative Esquivel's comments may well apply to every single law we pass, that there's always potential for unintended consequences. And I think, one of the challenges I think we're facing right now is it's been so many years and years and years since we've done any kind of serious ethics reform. I would hope that we come back maybe in 2008 and 2009, 2011, et cetera, and look at, as there are opportunities to fix specific pieces, maybe fix specific pieces that are new that we've created, or fix specific other pieces with other parts of the ethics law that we've not yet dealt with. I actually like the dedicated funds piece where we specifically say we're going to take this out of the annual general fund debate, which has been what's helped reduce the annual funding of the Ethics Commission over time. I actually really like that piece. The $50 gift limit, I have no clue whether that's too low or too high or perfectly articulated here or not. I think clearly we need to have a limit that we don't have in place, a lower limit than we have in place right now. I won't try the $50, and I'm willing to be convinced a year from now or 2 years from now that it's not the right number. But I think the challenge we've got is we are going to adjourn this week, and this bill arrived last week, basically, in the House, and we've just got a very narrow window, as Representative Buckley said, to make sure that we do move the ball forward on this, recognizing that we have not addressed every issue, but we've made some major progress forward in ethics, both with the House rules we've passed as well as with this package, give this coupled with giving the Ethics Commission some new financial tools to actually be able to have staff to implement this and other ethics provisions, I think will be a significant advance forward.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. And I would agree with those who have said that this bill is not perfect. I think it would be very difficult to come up with a perfect ethics bill, but I think a lot of hard work went into this bill on the Senate side. I appreciate those that have come forward and shared their thoughts. We certainly have made some changes to try to accommodate some of the concerns that we heard today. But I think, you know, the bill does a lot of very good things that we haven't even really had time to talk about today. I mean, in addition to the funding mechanism, which we clearly needed to come up with an independent source of funding, and this bill does that. The bill increases penalties in a meaningful way. The bill does deal with gift limits, which clearly we had to do that this session. And I think, you know, one of the most significant things in the bill is that it does now provide an official mechanism for the Government Standards and Practices Commission to come to the legislature every time we meet with recommendations for updating the laws that they enforce and recommending any changes and things that they see that can work better than they currently do. So though the bill is not perfect, I think it's a very good bill, and I'm glad that we will be able to move it to the floor. Yes, Representative Roper.
And just a short statement, you know, and I think most people have said the things they've said, but that have to do with this bill, and I understand everybody's perspective. The big thing for me is that I hope that with the extra money that's going to our Ethics Commission, that we clearly get out rules and stuff and good information to all the local people who are doing all of these things, who are covered by these rules. You know, it's not just about us. This covers a lot of people in the state of Oregon, and they need to have the information. They need to know what it is and some of that information to make sure that they can do their jobs ethically and understand what they're doing. And I think it's been one of the places we've had the biggest problem, from my perspective, is having that information out there to all of those people. And we had that discussion in our previous bills, and I know that that's part of the budget stuff, but you know, it's hard for people when they don't know that the rule exists and they do it wrong. So we need to make sure that education piece is really out there for all those local governments.
Thank you, members, for the comments. And Brian, will you please call the roll?
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
No.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Roblin.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Excused.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senate Bill 10B as amended moves to the floor. Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I am deeply disappointed that the work of the Law Commission is left on the cutting room floor, and I hope to at least have the opportunity to present it. I am serving notice of minority report.
Representative Berger serves notice of a possible minority report on Senate Bill 10. We will assign Representative Merkley to carry this bill on the floor, and assuming he is agreeable, I think he will be. And members, thank you very much for your patience today. And with nothing further to come before us, committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.